the idea is to equip them to solve their own problems. So they take an ownership of their own training program by the time they're elite level. And then, you know, then once they've taken owner with the degree of ownership comes a large degree of accountability, you know. So, so those are the three things: clarity, support, and accountability.
The N plus one global yet very local cycling podcast, brought to you by Lowland Cycling.
Hi and good day. This is the Lowland Cycling podcast, and my name is Jerry De Bruin. My co-host Jeff is on the way. He will be here shortly, but we have another very great guest with us, Andrew Harris. Andrew, good afternoon. How are you?
Good, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Andrew, you got introduced by Mandy Margard, you're Mandy's coach. Again, thank you for being here. Andrew, could you tell us a little bit more about your background, how you got started with coaching and cycling in general?
Yeah, going back, I was a competitive cyclist in my 20s. It's kind of an interesting start to cycling. I was a kid that did, I tried everything. I played, you know, football, basketball, baseball, hockey, tried it all and enjoyed it all. And, but my real passion as a youngster was motorcycle racing, motocross racing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And, inherent to that sport are a lot of injuries. And, so I hurt myself quite a few times, and I had two really severe knee injuries, and I started cycling to rehab the knee injuries. And, you know, just started, my dad was a touring cyclist, and, you know, so I started riding the bike with him a little bit outdoors, and started to catch an interest in bike racing. And I'd actually seen a track race years before I had any interest in racing the bike. My dad and I were in England, and I actually saw the World Track Cycling Championships just by chance.
Right.
And thought it looked kind of interesting at that point. And then it all came full circle. And so I didn't really start cycling until I was in my early 20s. I spent about 10 years as a motocross racer.
Right.
And just got into cycling from because of the injuries.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's a common thread that we hear often with previous athletes that we interviewed, whether it's soccer or wrestling or any other sport. The rehab getting into cycling is how many cyclists get started. I think more in the US than it would be in Europe. Obviously, they have rehab there also, but growing up cycling is a little bit more common there than it is in the US.
Right.
So, and then from cycling getting into coaching, was that kind of like a fluent motion into coaching? How did that
just all my interests in sport. Mm-hmm. I started in college. I was actually a business student, and then kind of halfway through my degree, I discovered, you know, my real interest was in physiology. So I kind of backed up, changed majors, and continued with sports science. I have a master's degree in sports science. Okay. And then I started coaching. I was coaching as a strength and conditioning coach for high schools, all the high school sports, particularly football programs and that kind of thing. But I still had the passion for cycling, and came back to cycling after several years. I came back to cycling. I had a job offer as a strength conditioning coach for the American Cycling Academy here in Trexler Town. And I took that, and it's been from there on ever since. You know, the cycling academy kind of crumbled apart, and then I just decided to continue on coaching my own athletes.
Right. Yeah, the Trexel Town, T-Town Velodrome is, let's say, world famous, right? And were you born and raised in this area, or are you originally from
I'm originally from Virginia. It's what they call Southside Virginia, which is tobacco farming country, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And what brought you to this area? Was that the Velodrome?
I took the job as a strength and conditioning coach, and the velodrome was what brought me back to T-town area.
So currently you coach, but you also have a team, right? And that's if I'm correct, predominantly track cyclists.
Right. Correct. Right. Yeah, I started our team in 2012, I believe it was. We were originally named Sprinter's Edge, and we kind of saw a void at the time in T-town. There weren't really any active sprint coaches. So I thought, you know, I would kind of fill that void, and I did. And I started with two athletes, and we've grown over the years to currently we have 25 to 30 athletes in our program, including our junior development program, our elite program, and then a handful of masters cyclists as well.
Right.
2 years ago, we changed our name to Edge Cycling because we took on an endurance aspect too.
Oh, okay.
Primarily focused on track endurance, mm-hmm. But of course, road training and road racing is a big part of the preparation for a track endurance rider. So
exactly.
But we do have both sprinters and endurance athletes in our program.
Right. Right. Yeah. So that's quite a number of athletes that you coach, and I would assume you're not doing it all by yourself.
No. I have some helpers. We have a unique program. I have a gentleman, Coach Roberts, who helps with our endurance program quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And then we're unique in the aspect that our elite eight cyclists, they spend a lot of time with our junior cyclists, and they spend a lot of time helping them along.
Oh, so okay.
it's a really neat environment because, the not only comes from the coaching staff, but also from their peers as well.
So, oh, okay. That is pretty unique, and that's great, right? It's mm-hmm. it's almost like a community within a community, and these younger riders always look up to the older, more achieved riders. So that's cool. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Is that one of the things that makes your, let's say, coaching and the team unique, working with each other, and what are other things that make your more coaching unique or mm-hmm. different than others, if any?
Yeah, I think that is a unique element in our program. I'm not quite sure what others do, but the fact that our elite athletes, they're expected to, and they take on the tasks willingly. They really enjoy, I think, contributing and giving back to the younger kids. We've been blessed to have some very good athletes that have had some degree of success in our program. And it's really a great opportunity for the youngsters to learn from those guys. So, yeah, I think that is a big part of our program, actually. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Hi, Jeff. Good afternoon.
Hey. How you doing? Sorry for joining late.
Yeah, no worries. So we are beyond, we already started, so we're recording, and we're kind of beyond the introduction. So we're talking about the team, the team size, and what makes the team and the coaching unique. Andrew was explaining that the older riders actually help coach the younger riders. So that's I think that's super cool. Do you have your own facility
Yes, we do in Bryanicksville. We're about four miles from the velodrome.
Okay.
And we have here at my house, we have a large pole building, a pole barn that we've converted into a training facility. We have a pretty comprehensive gym set up, and of course it's important for not only the sprinters, but particularly the sprinters and the endurance guys too. And then we have a fleet of watt bikes and trainers and that kind of thing that we use in the winter. The winters are pretty cold here, and that's one of the disadvantages we have, particularly for the sprinters again. But at the same time, we found ways to overcome that.
Right. Yeah, I remember with Mandy that she, as she was talking about doing her sprint, because the velodrome was closed during COVID, so right. She was doing her workouts outdoors often, but also sometimes on Swift on the watt bike. And she said, it's sometimes I get questions where people look at my stats and they see all these short bursts, right. And that's yeah. what you normally would do on the velodrome.
We spent a lot of time doing lot of road sprints and things this spring,
right.
when the velodrome was closed. Fortunately, the velodrome found a way to yes. open, you know, and with some pretty strict guidelines to follow. But right. you know, they actually had a little racing series, and we were able to train there most of the summer. So it was a big, huge advantage for us to have that available.
Yeah, yeah, that was good to see. So you have your own gym, obviously, with all the. I guess also with the strength equipment, like the weights and the weight room, et cetera, that's also part of what you have.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Yeah. That's a, you know, with the sprinter, that's a huge part of their program that, you know, just as the endurance, their base comes from big mileage and that kind of thing. The sprinter's base comes from the strength that they develop in the gym, basically. Yeah. So,
right.
And we do have all the basics that we need to develop their strength.
Right.
So with the different disciplines, is the base similar across all the different like track events? Do they train in January and do kind of the same similar base and then go more specific from that point on?
No, with both of our sets of athletes, the endurance guys and the sprint athletes, I use what I guess most would call like a complex system of training. Okay. And I'll just take it from the sprint side. Mm-hmm. We divided the sprint athletes' training program into four different categories of exercises, and then there's subdivisions among those. So with the sprinters, we have about 13 different characteristics of training that we do, and we train all 13 of those year round. So there's really not a base period and a build period. And, you know, although we do cycle through our training, we're constantly training all of those characteristics year round. And we believe that there's a synergistic effect from training those. And it's kind of unique because it takes a lot of data, a lot of monitoring of data. Mm-hmm. But we find with our elite athletes that we can define there's a very defined period of how long it will take them to reach a peak
right.
with this method. So we try to, you know, tailor with those guys. We tailor the program very carefully to try to help, you know, help them reach peak fitness at the proper time. And then we can, you know, once they've reached that peak athletic form, then we can modify the training at that point to either have them reach the big peak for a major race or perhaps maintain a peak for a period of time through a period of time where they may be racing multiple times over several weeks and that kind of thing.
Right.
Gotcha. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen like the YouTube videos about sweet spot versus polarized training, but it's kind of blown up. Everyone's
right.
All the group rides. That's what everyone talks about. Is
right.
Like,
right. Right. You know,
in the comments were interesting because everyone said, well, for the time crunch cyclist or the over 40 cyclist, you know, you have to do the specific training. You can't just go out and just
noodle muddle
around for 8 hours. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what we find, you know, we're spending three months, you know, developing a base for, we've missed 3 months of specific training that we can be doing to get good at what we're actually trying to do.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Right.
Yeah. That's so interesting. So that, the training program that you have and collecting the data, is that something that you develop yourself or do you use tools to help you with that?
Yeah, I use a lot of tools. I mean, a lot of the things we've developed ourselves, a lot mm-hmm. of things, you know, I've gotten from, I don't know that anybody does it all themselves, obviously.
Right.
You know, we've stolen things from a lot of our stuff comes from outside of cycling. You know, the ideas that I've developed have probably come from other sports versus cycling. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, sprint cycling, is pretty, the information on training and stuff is pretty guarded.
Right.
And sometimes I'll find it's a little easier to get ideas from other sports than it is from cycling itself, for track, from track training anyway.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it's also applying that, the theory into practice, and you build your experience over many years, right? It's not right. just reading a book or an article and apply it and magic happens. Yeah. That's not how it works.
Yeah, I was just talking the other day with someone and talking about how we're constantly adjusting stuff and learning stuff all the time. And
right.
You know, it's exciting. There's a lot of new sports science, you know, things that are coming out, and we're learning from that and applying them to the sprinters as well as the endurance guys.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you see that like that? Me personally, and I think Jeff also, it's a very exciting time. The last couple of years, the wealth of knowledge with the equipment, the software, whether it's from a material, tools, or maybe even nutrition, it's like it's hockey sticking. There is so much out there. Do you also feel the same about that?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, there is. You know, there's probably, you know, most of the technology that you see that's commercially available, I think, is probably geared a little more to the endurance side. Mm-hmm. The endurance side, it's probably a little more practical tool for them.
Right.
But you know, we've learned ways of, you know, using the same types of tools for the sprinters. I'm a little old school. I'm not a huge technology guy. So I have a lot of, if you look at my office, it's an absolute mess. I have notes written everywhere and stuff. So I have tons of data. Yeah. Compiling it is the problem for me sometimes. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. Like I'm predominantly a mountain biker, and even 3-4 years ago, people were like, power meters on a mountain bike. That's kind of it's a novelty. Yeah. It's like, well, you're so start and stop, it doesn't matter. But now it's prevalent. Everyone's got one, and you're measuring it on the road. You want to measure it on the mountain bike. You want to compare as similar as you can. So, yeah, it's interesting to see how that just, you know, grows within the sport too.
Right.
And now that's become like a standard.
Right. Right.
Yeah, 100%.
Do you have riders that span different disciplines? Like maybe they do track and then they do cross in the winter or anything like that. How do you manage that, where you're training specifically for one discipline and then switching to something completely different?
Right. The sprint, I'll start with that. That's so specialized that our riders don't participate in any other disciplines. They do some road training, but no road racing. It's just, it would be detrimental to their development. Except for the young guys, you know, the young developing juniors, they may spend some time on the road and possibly do some road racing in their younger years. Our track endurance guys are, you know, I'd say 80-85% of their training is done. Training time is spent on the road, and doing some road and criterium racing. So it's big for them. But the sprinters, no. None at all. No cross disciplines there. Yeah, we do have some of our junior endurance guys that do cross in the fall, and then you know, the road early spring season, the sprint predominantly on the road, and then we specialize in the track, just, you know, kind of at the last minute before any major events. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, we've spoken about this on the podcast before, but like Bobby Lee going from he was a pure road cyclist for years, right, with the Toyota United team. And then he was doing track. And then now he got into mountain biking. And it's like, we saw it. Like, he didn't show up and start winning races, every race that he won.
Yeah.
He had to figure it out. So he had to, like, kind of transfer his engine into something else. You know, he's definitely figured it out now. But do you help with people transitioning if they want to get into something that their body's not tuned for, but you can figure out like how to change it for them?
Oh yeah. In fact, you know, that's with our sprinters, a lot of times that's just the case. We'll find an athlete that we feel, just from observation, is just probably in the wrong discipline. Mm-hmm. There's not a big, typically not a big push to direct people towards sprinting. So a lot of Mandy Markowitz, a great example. You know, we approached her in 2014, I believe it was. And I said, look, you're a sprinter, you know, why don't you give sprinting a full-time try. And it took a little convincing, but she did. And it took, it really took a couple of years to kind of get the endurance out of her and kind of turn on the, you know, the sprint muscle. And, we've had some, you know, she's obviously had some success and, but that's often the case, you know, it's a, I'll see a lot of young athletes in the area now that, you know, in other programs that I feel like, boy, they're headed the wrong direction. You know, they can be a decent cyclist where they're going, but if they really wanted to be, you know, a top international competitor, they need to head another direction. Right. So I think that's, you know, a thing we're missing in cycling in the U.S. a lot of times is a talent and identification and directing the athlete towards an area where they're going to be successful.
Yeah, I think that's a common thread too that we've seen on the podcast is people said, well, I started off with triathlons and then I realized I was really good on the bike and then I became a time trialist. And it's like, you almost need someone with an objective view of their, you know, of what they're achieving to say, I think you're doing this. You should be over in this category.
Exactly.
So, right.
Yeah. I think you just have blinders on. You just think you're going to be one type of cyclist and you're better at something else.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. What is your, what are your thoughts about cycling for the future? And for example, looking at track cycling, one of the things that I think that happened in 2020 is that USA Cycling canceled the youth development program for track cyclists. And I was just like mind blown. Is why would you do that? I don't understand, right? It's why would you cancel a program like that compared to others? What do you think about future, let's say, development and things that have to change?
Yeah, I just had a discussion a couple of weeks ago on this very subject. It's interesting. I think. That was the program you're talking about that was canceled because it was the Olympic Development Program, which is the developing program for sprinters and track endurance guys. I think in the U.S., I feel like we were kind of trying to model ourselves after perhaps like Great Britain, where they take, you know, it's a small country about the size of Pennsylvania, actually. And I think they, you know, they with that ability to have a small country and many velodromes around the country, they're able to kind of centralize their program at a young age. Where, my opinion, in the U.S., we're a massive country. You know, it's it's a 3,000-mile flight to get to our only indoor velodrome. And I think the mistake, you know, we make is maybe trying to centralize our programs too early, particularly on the track. Right. We don't have many tracks, so I think what we need to do is actually create regional or state systems of developing track riders or you know around the velodromes, and I think there has to be a big emphasis on coaching education, bringing coaches up to speed in the track specialties, and going that route. So I think it's decentralizing the programs until you develop a rider to a pretty high level where they're on the door knocking at the ability to compete at an international level before we start centralizing them. So I think we're centralizing too early. We need to decentralize, build the athlete from the ground up and then bring them together at the very end, basically.
Right. Track cycling is a stepping stone for a lot of different disciplines, right? If you remain on the track, but if you take, for example, the UK Grand Tour winners started off as track cyclists they developed themselves and won the Tour de France, for example. And that's another great example. And that's especially for young kids and their parents, it's a safe environment to start off with, right? You don't have to go on the road.
I always, you know, when I started off my cycling career on the road and didn't find the track until late, but I always thought, boy, I learned more about a finish in one night on the track than I probably do a month of criterium racing, you know, where I'm finishing, you know, five or six times in one night, you know, sprints, points race, this and that. And on the road, it took me, you know, 50 miles of criterium racing before I got to that one finish. So I think the learning curve is so much steeper. Plus you develop the, you know, the track capacities are very high capacity, you know, then it's, you know, once you have those very high aerobic capacities and that kind of thing, then it's just a matter of building that, that bigger, endurance base for the road. You know, it's an easy transfer from track to road versus road to track.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of strategy that goes into the track racing too. Right. And you go to a missing out and, the fastest guy probably doesn't win, right? It's the cagiest, the most savvy, you know, that can read a pack.
Right.
So I think it's like learning those road racing skills at lightning pace because everything happens so quickly on the track.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So I grew up around Texas and Southwest, and I remember the EDS team was a huge influence. They were down in Houston racing every weekend. That led to road teams, and just having one main sponsor like that just grew so much of the cycling in the area. And when it went away, then, you know, we lost this huge opportunity. So what do you think we could do to encourage more sponsors to come in and to take more of an advantage of these opportunities?
I think the that's a question I've been trying to answer for a long time, and I'm not very good at it. You know, that's one of the things we have difficulty. We have our other team is forming partnerships. You know, and my feeling is, you know, the onus is on us, the coaches and the riders. We've got to get a result. You know, we've got to start getting some top results, so that there's, you know, so that we're marketable for those types of companies. You know, it's like, so I understand, you know, it's an investment for them and they're looking for a return on investment. The EDS program was kind of unique. I think that they had some people inside the company that had a very big interest in track cycling. Right. And, you know, I think kind of stems from that. But yeah, that's certainly, you know, a step that's got to happen. I think we've got to see larger, you know, corporate private sponsorships come into track cycling.
Yeah. Right. It seems to be a U.S. problem, right? And it feels like European teams, they have sponsors lined up and they continue almost like EF Education has been able to do that, but they're not typical of a U.S. team, right? Where they just have these sponsors roll in.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not a great one to comment on all that because I, like I said, I'm so focused on the coaching aspect of it that I spend too little time, you know, trying to develop the partnerships and that kind of thing that we need to do.
Travel with your team to, for example, Europe and do any of the, let's say, tournaments there, or maybe even the 3 or 6 day events. Is that?
Yes, we do. I've traveled, you know, with our team. We will go. Last year, we went to Belgium for the international track meeting in Belgium. Planning on doing that again this spring if it's going to happen. Okay. There's a date on the calendar in the middle of April, and we're hoping to be able to do that. So we do. We're trying to take that next step. We, you know, fortunately here in T-Town, we have a good series of UCI racing. So we're able to face some good international competition there, but, you know, we're trying to get a little more race experience at that higher level. Right. And by traveling to Europe, we're able to do that. I do travel. I travel some with USA Cycling. Mm-hmm. You know, I traveled last year was at the Pan Am Championships,
right.
A couple of the World Cups and the World Championships with USA Cycling. So, but as far as the club, yeah, we do go to Europe or where we can find higher levels of competition, and we plan on growing that and doing more of it in the future.
Right.
I think it's a necessary next step. Yes.
The previous Pan Am Championships, was that in Bolivia?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So the Erik Nyland, who one of our previous guests, he lives in, and I'm probably mispronouncing it, Cochabamba, where they have the new velodrome.
Cochabamba.
Where they have the new velodrome. So you went to that place and had the Pan Am championship.
Yes.
There.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, it's super high altitude. I don't remember the number of meters exactly now, but, you know, it was super for the conditions where, of course, you know, where new world record was set there in the sprint.
Right.
9.910. You know, from Nicholas Paul from Trinidad, one of our cyclists, one of our team cyclists, James Mellon, set the American record there. And so it was a unique experience, and just incredibly fast conditions. It was interesting to see.
Right. Yeah. It was interesting because Eric was explaining that that velodrome is especially good for sprinters. Whereas you would, for example, do a world hour record, you want to be at an even higher altitude. So I think that that velodrome is around 26 or 2700 meters. And if you want to go to do an hour record, it's a 3000 and above sea level. So it's interesting. I thought altitude is altitude, but there is absolutely a difference there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a thing. I mean, off the top of my head, is Bolivia was about 9,000 feet.
Right.
I'm not sure what that would convert to in meters, but it was. It's about 3,000 meters higher than Colorado Springs,
right.
And which brought a whole new element. You know, right. That extra 3,000 meters was a. You know, you think, well, I'm going to adapt at altitude in Colorado Springs and then go to Bolivia, but I do believe that extra 3,000 feet. You know, made a difference,
right?
In performances, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's almost tree line over here, right, in the US, right? I think 10,000 is tree line,
right? Yeah,
that's crazy.
So, yeah.
So I know on the road, a lot of teams will send their riders to Belgium or to Europe in general, and just so that they can experience racing over there because it is so different from the US, right? Mm-hmm. Is it the same with track, where when they go to these other countries, they race differently and they're learning different strategies?
Yeah. Obviously with the track endurance, I think I would say the racing certainly faster and more aggressive in Europe. On the sprint side, if you want to face the big competition, you know, Europe is probably the place to go. Mm-hmm. The difference being with a sprinter, you know, if you're not reaching a certain time standard, you're going to go to travel Europe and you're going to do sprint qualifying. And if you're not fast enough, you're not going to even make the racing, you know, you're just going to be sent back home. Or if you do make the racing, you know, and you barely, you know, qualify in 28th place or something, then you're going to face the top qualifier. You're likely to make an early exit out of the sprint tournament. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's hard to go unless you're at a very high level and gain a meaningful amount of experience. So it's a little bit different particularly for the track sprinter.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah. And you even see a lot of the track riders that will go into the Southern Hemisphere and go race, you know, they do a full season in the US, then they go down to Australia and New Zealand and they're racing down there. Are they allowed a bigger window to race because the disciplines are shorter or the races are shorter?
Yeah, I would say typically a sprinter races quite a bit less than an endurance guy, much less. Okay. The majority of the time is spent in the, in training. And, we feel that it takes, you know, maybe 6-7 competitions before our rider, you know, rider really reaches a peak. You know, we need to have that many competitions, where a road rider has, you know, many, many more than that, I think, right. You know, during the, you know, a lot of their training is road riders training is done in racing situations, where the track riders, you know, are in the gym and on the track doing very specialized things. But the racing opportunity, and it's such a high intensity of things that the track sprinter is doing, that you know what actually would probably be detrimental performance to race too much.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and I was thinking the previous guest, Colleen Gerlich, she was talking about going to Belgium to do a 6 days, and then she would encounter Kirsten Wild, for example, and she said it's just like at such a different level, but they are open to talk and to exchange some experiences, and she found that extremely motivating to be around those type of, let's say, super elite track cyclists. So, yeah. Right.
Yeah, we made our trip to Ghent last year, and we had a young girl with a very little track experience kind of get her feet wet in Belgium. And it was a tough experience because, you know, it almost seemed tougher to me than a World Cup because, you know, there wasn't just one Dutch girl. There was five Dutch girls and five Belgian girls, you know, and all pretty equal strength. So the racing was almost, you know, more dynamic and then a lot tougher than even a World Cup. The speeds were incredible.
Yeah.
And so it was a real eye opener for her. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember, was it with, I think our one of our interviews, we talked about different sports that led to being good track riders, and they talked about gymnasts being good at track. What other sports do you think would be a good feeder into track racing?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned gymnasts. I have two of our young junior developing female cyclists are former. One was a former level 10 gymnast, which is just a step below an elite gymnast, and the other was a high level gymnast too. And they're showing, you know, they build such great athletic skills and power and speed and stuff through gymnastics. So I think that's a great sport for transfer, especially the girls that maybe that grow a little too large to be, you know, to be gymnasts, you know, mm-hmm. where they're big, powerful girls, and but they have that, they've developed those athletic skills through gymnastics, and now they're bringing them to the track, which is in comparisons a relatively simplistic sport to gymnastics as far as technique and technical ability. Any sport that you know, emphasizes explosive power, and, you know, speaking towards a sprinter, you know, explosive strength and power. You know, we in the US we lose a lot of athletes obviously to, you know, to football, the mainstream sports, you know, football and stuff, but the football players, soccer play, you know, there's a lot of different sports that I think, you know, Kelsey Mitchell from Canada, who's one of the top sprinters in the world now, came from soccer. Matilda Gros from France was a former basketball player. So a lot of these countries, and I think the U.S. actually has a transfer of talent program where they're looking for athletes. They're perhaps not quite there in their sport, or maybe they've been injured and they want to, you know, they're looking for a different avenue. So I think that's a very important aspect of, you know, what, you know, bringing athletes into track cycling.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I think injuries, how most people find cycling, right?
Right. Yeah, we were just talking. That's how Andrew got into cycling himself. He was a motocross, did that 10 years competitively, and injuries got him into cycling. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Rehab.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even our last interview, Molly van Howling, she was a synchronous swimmer, and she specializes on the TT, and she said that really helped because she is flexible and lean to really get into that very specific time trial position, so she made a lot of gains there in the wind tunnel, and so it's pretty amazing. Looking at your team, how do you get new athletes on your team? Do you go out and approach athletes yourself, and or do they find you because you're a household name in the sprinting and track cyclist for track cycling?
Some of both. I mean, you know, we have it's a pretty tight-knit cycling community here. The Velodrome has a pretty large, we're very fortunate because they have a large community program, you know, with bringing kids into entry-level track cycling, Air Products and the Air Products program, and then the Bicycle Racing League. So we, you know, if we see a cyclist that we feel like, you know, would fit into our, you know, our mold, so to speak, you know, we'll approach them. And then, you know, since it is such a small community, we do have, you know, guys that are just come up to us and say, what does it take to get on to the Edge program or whatever. Right. So, yeah.
Right.
But, yeah.
And what does it take to get on the team?
Yeah. Well, from our, we have, you know, interesting with Edge, because we coach anything from a very raw beginner all the way up to the elite competitors. Right. So depending on what age they come in, basically the young guys, you know, we just look for them to have a desire to get better, right. You know, to enjoy the sport. We don't screen. There's no, basically no entry criteria that we're looking for other than an interest to get better.
Right.
With the elite guys, you know, we're a lot more, the vetting process is a lot right. greater there. We're looking for number one, I look for an elite competitor. You know, we're looking for somebody that, you know, is competitive in every situation. And particularly when they get in the tough situations, we want them to step up and,
right.
and be big in those situations. Number two, we look for toughness. You know, cycling's a tough sport, whether it's sprint or endurance road, right. you know, whatever discipline you're in, it's all very hard. Mm-hmm. So we're looking for a certain degree of toughness. We're looking for leaders that come into our program is probably the third category. The thing I look at is, you know, we want somebody that comes in our elite program that is not only going to be, you know, working for themselves, but show an interest to get better than themselves, but also to pass that on to the guys coming up below them. Mm-hmm. And then we, you know, a couple other qualities we look for, guys that are intelligent and unadaptable. But those are the five qualities that we look for in our elite cyclists. But at the junior level, at the lower levels, we don't have any vetting process. I think the biggest mistake or the biggest fall down of a development program is just not keeping the riders in the sport long enough,
because right.
you never know how they're going to develop it. You know, when they come to you at 13, 14, 15 years old, you really don't know what you have your hands on until they're 18, 19 or 20. So
right.
that's the biggest challenge, is keeping the riders in the sport long enough so that they reach their potential.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So with that, with the junior riders, are you trying to instill in them, the discipline and the trust in the training so that they can see the results? Or is there also an element of you need to unlearn this, like you've been doing it one way and you should really switch to something else? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's interesting. When we bring a cyclist into the program, the number one thing we want to emphasize is building the team. And and to do that, you know, we need to develop a certain level of trust between a rider, not only the rider and the coaches, but also riders and other riders in the program. You know, our ultimate goal with our program is to get success at the top level, at the mm-hmm. international level. And the junior development program is nothing more than, you know, giving them what they're capable of handling at their level so they get
right.
get to the elite level. But number one, we build trust. And then I guess the second most important thing is we want to develop a crystal clear clarity of what our team goals are, number one. Mm-hmm. And then number two, what their role is within that team, within our team, you know, which is simply being the best version, what we call the best version of them, or being elite where they are. And then once we're sure that they have a crystal clear vision of where we want to go and where we want them to go, you know, we got to make sure we have the systems of support in place so they're able to do that. So we have systems, you know, for physiology, nutrition, sports psychology, the technical aspects like aerodynamics. And we try to have all these things in place at a very high level, so that we want to equip them to, the idea is to equip them to solve their own problems.
Right.
So they take an ownership of their own training program by the time they're elite level. And then, you know, then once they've taken owner with the degree of ownership comes a large degree of accountability, you
exactly.
know? So those are the three things: clarity, support, and accountability with our model that we, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's interesting, because we interviewed Bart Bowen and he's coaching junior kids out in Bend, Oregon. And he said, you know, he's teaching them all the strategies and they go into Cat 3 crits and just run circles around all these like seasoned 40-year-old guys, you know, because
yeah.
they're playing all these tactics. Everyone knows what their position is and what they're supposed to be doing. And when they execute on that, you know, they all win. And so it's like gaining trust through seeing those results, you know? So I think that's important,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
It's easy to go into a race and second guess yourself and everything. But if you go in there with a plan and you see it executed well, then it's like, okay, then you have trust, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right.
And for that matter, 2020 with the pandemic and COVID brought, I guess, something new to coaching. Not having the velodrome, not having all the races, a lot of the goals were taken away. So if you talk about mental toughness and the discipline and accountability, how was that for you and your team?
Yeah, we were talking about this not long ago. I'm trying to the timeline. I came back from Europe, and then we went to Canada to a regional race up in Canada, came back, and that's about the time COVID hit. And we had a meeting with our athletes right away and said some we met in person, and then some we had Zoom meetings like this, but mm-hmm. said, hey, you know, we looks like we're going to have a big situation on our hands here, you know, and we got to make sure we have the right response to this. And we said we can either basically sit around, you know, feeling sorry for ourselves, or we're gonna, you know, use this opportunity to get better. Right. And our guys are really excited. Actually, you know, I didn't know how they would, I knew how they would respond, the elite guys, but they responded even stronger than I thought. You know, mm-hmm. they were super excited. They were like, they were hoping that we wouldn't even have a national championships, because they wanted to be able to piece together, you know, 12, 16, 18 months of training. Right. Just to get better, you know, so when they step back across the track, they're going to be they'll be a much better athlete. So right. That was kind of neat. And then our young athletes, you know, I was a little worried about them, because some of those guys have only, you know, they're just getting their feet wet. Right. So just worried about them keeping an interest in bike racing. And they've, you know, so we've tried to do some things like some indoor racing and just some little things to keep them energized, and you know, they've responded really well too. So both groups, from the elite guys down to the younger juniors, are, you know, we've made a tremendous amount of progress, you know, during the COVID period. We'll see when the racing begins, but I think, you know, that we're going to see a lot of improvement.
Right. So, you have the data, right? So right, you can see those gains.
Right. Right.
Of course, they have to be applied. Rubber meets the road type of principle, but okay, that's interesting to hear that they actually were excited. Just getting stronger and better, and talk about focus, and
we talk a lot about closing the gap. You know, right. Like we know that, you know, the Dutch and the British are here, you know, and we're here, and we've got to close that gap, but we've got to do, you know, we've got to, and they're still improving as well. So we've got to improve at a much faster rate than they do. So I think they're excited about the opportunity to maybe cut into that gap some by really just having a long, uninterrupted block of training.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So when the racing resumes, is mm-hmm. there going to be a change based on the COVID protocol that you're going to have to do things differently?
We don't know at this point. No, I don't really know. I wish I knew.
Yeah, because in the mountain biking, we switched to a time trial format. And I think everyone at first was just like, this is going to be horrible. I don't want to do it, you know. And then we got a few races in and everyone's like, I kind of like it. You know, you essentially get to choose your own lines. You're not waiting for other people. No one's holding you up. So I think everyone's adapted, and now everyone's looking forward to the season.
Yeah, we did have that opportunity here at Drexler Town this summer. They had a Ocean Spray put on a time trial series. Mm-hmm. So we were able to do that, which is a huge help, kind of keeping things going through the summer months. And I don't know that there's any talk of that, you know, at the higher levels, you know, national championships or, you know, international racing, whether they would go to a time trial format. I mean, they have held the European championships, and there's some other racing going on. There was a big UCI race down in Colombia a couple of weeks ago. So there's some things happening with normal racing format. So I think that's what we'll see when racing does resume in full.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would definitely favor the dedicated cyclists that are willing to train on their own, right?
Right.
Like you tell them there's a time trial, they're like, great, let's do it.
Right.
Other people are like, I need someone to give me the motivation.
Yeah. Right? That's been a challenge, especially with a couple of our young endurance guys. They're like, it's hard to get them to do the effort levels that they need to do without racing, without, seeing somebody with a target on the back in front of
right. them.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So that's let's assume that COVID is behind. So a second half of the year, obviously, hopefully, the Olympics are happening. Do you have any specific events with your athletes that you're looking at and preparing for?
Yes. Well, Mandy is on the Olympic long team. So right. Our big objective with her is the World Cups, with the new Nations Cup races. We have one in April in Wales, and then the second one will be in Hong Kong in May.
Right.
So those are the big focus, and they will be the deciders of who's going to Tokyo.
Right.
And so those are the two big events we're focused with her. With the developing sprinters, we have our first big focus would be national championships in July. And then we have a UCI series here, three or four races
right.
At the end of July, the beginning of August, right here in T-Town.
Right.
We're planning, actually, before that, we're planning on maybe Belgium in mm-hmm. April, if that happens. And then after that, we'll see where it goes. And we'll have a little idea of where they are. And, there's not much schedule out there at this point, but
yeah.
We'll probably... If they're advancing like we think they are, we'll probably make some trips to Europe over the winter,
right?
To get a little more racing experience. Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, I feel like we have a couple of two or three young sprinters that are probably a year and a half, two years away from an international result. International being able to compete at the international level.
Right.
So that's where we are with them.
Okay.
Mandy is obviously. Knocking on the door of a really good results. I had a couple of, a top five World Cup appearance this year, and a couple of top tens. So she's progressed nicely. Mm-hmm. We think she'll have a good shot at making the Tokyo team.
Right.
And then she's planning on continuing on for another Olympic cycle. So we're excited about that, because I think her best years are ahead of her. Yeah.
Right. Right. And for Ed Cycling, and maybe personally for yourself, what are your goals as a team and as a coach? Do you have any goals?
Yeah, we have our initiative. We call it Integrity 2024 mm-hmm. and 2028, looking ahead. But basically, our team, our mission is to. Basically win some of the biggest bike races in the world, by those years,
right.
World Cup or Nations Cup events, now the Pan Am Championships, World Championships, and ultimately, the Olympic Games. But that's where we are. Of course, that would, we would pass athletes on to USA Cycling at that point, but we want athletes out of our program achieving those things. Yes.
Okay, that's great. So if there are people listening and they want to become a partner and help you sponsor.
<That's right. laughs> Absolutely. We'd love to talk to you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Andrew. I'm conscious about your time. You have to prepare for your, let's say, afternoon session with your team in the gym. But
a suffering session this afternoon. So it's a tough session. So it's always fun to be involved with it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but
thanks for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you guys, and hopefully we'll talk again soon. And you're in. Where are you located? Mandy was telling me.
We are both in Exton. Exton. That's what is it? An hour.
Right
from okay. from Trexton,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we promised Mandy and others that we'll visit the velodrome, and we'll make sure to connect.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'll be glad to meet you. We look forward to meeting you in person.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Right, okay. Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
Same to you. Bye bye.
Yeah.